Fairy is presented by the writers and illustrators of the future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we chat with award-winning writer Scott T. Barnes. We talk about writing and inspiration and all kinds of stuff. Here's Scott. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry.
How are you?
I am doing great.
How's everything in your part of the world?
Well, I feel pretty good. I had a year-end meeting for a little museum that I'm a part of today, and I was able to report that we still have a little cash in the bank, which is not always the case in it for a nonprofit. So I'm feeling pretty good.
Hey, it's always good when you're in the positive.
That's right.
Any business, but I love museums. I live in San Diego. We have the Balboa Park, and it's filled with museums, and I just love going there. Do you have a favorite museum in your area other than yours?
Actually, Balboa Park is one of my favorite places in the world.
Me too!
Yes, I love just hanging out there. 7th and 8th grade both, I made the science fair, which meant I got to go from my little hometown of Julian and present my windmill project at the science fair and spend an entire week at Balboa Park, more or less on my own with the other people from our school. It was incredible. And ever since then, I've had a love affair with Balboa Park, museums, the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, we just went to the Space and Air Museum a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, Reuben H. Fleet Space Theater. Oh, no, you're talking about the other one.
No, the one that's in the park. It's sort of separated from everything else. It's like, there used to be like a gym, but there's now the Comic-Con Museum next door to it, which I haven't been to yet. I usually go on free days, so I only go one museum at a time, and I don't...
Well, that's smart, yeah.
But, I mean, I love going there. It's so pretty, and it's so relaxing, and there's so many... like, the gardens there are gorgeous. You don't have to pay anything for that.
Do they still have a Starlight Opera there?
I don't know. I know, of course, the Globe is there. But
right.
I don't know about the
classic
opera. I have never been to the opera. I would love to go to the opera.
Well, they usually, if they're still there, they show musicals. Not serious opera, but things like Annie Gets Your Gun and this sort of thing, but they're well known because it's outdoors, and it's right under the flight path to San Diego Airport. So every time a plane goes overhead, the actors freeze wherever they are for 10-15 seconds, and then they pick everything up right then, right where they left off, and it's pretty fun.
There's
a new dimension to it.
That's like the at the Globe when they do Shakespeare, you sit on the lawn, you just like bring a picnic and you sit on the lawn, and they're doing Shakespeare right in the front of where the Globe is. I don't know if they still do that. They used to do that. Like, I think the last time I saw one of those was in the 2000s. I don't know if they still do it though.
I'm sure that they do. I've seen one a lot more recent, maybe 4 years ago, something like that. Well, it was before the lockdowns, but I think they're probably still there.
But the Globe, you go inside, you know, you go into the I love that place. It really looks like the Globe Theater. It's just, I was gawking in every section of the place you go in when you first go in. The opening hall. I was gawking at all that stuff. It was just so gorgeous. It was built so perfectly. The first time I was supposed to go to the Globe was when I was in school. I was in high school, and we were supposed to go. And during the fires, it burned down. It's kind of ironic if you think about it, because the Globe in London has burned down twice. This is the third resurrection of it. And the Globe in San Diego burned down once. You're just like, what is it like? Some kind, but I didn't get to go, and it took me years to finally get to go to see a show there.
Sounds like I need to bring my kids there.
It's beautiful. And it's right. And it's not just Shakespeare. I mean, they had same time next year, they had A Bell, Book, and Candle. They have all kinds of, my mom and my brother and I, we went to see A Room with a View. Musical version of A Room with a View.
Was that Alfred Hitchcock originally?
No, A Room with a View is, you're thinking Rear Window, I think.
Okay.
Rear Window's the one with Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly, is that what you're thinking of?
I'm not good with actor names.
Okay. Okay, but Room with a View was with Helena Bonham Carter and Maggie Smith. They're supposed to be in Italy on vacation.
Uh-huh.
And it was written, the book was written by Ian Forrester. It's one of my favorite books. And,
two great actors. I do remember their names. Yeah.
And Daniel Day-Lewis, when they go back to England, he's in that part of it.
Wow.
I mean, and Judi Dench is in it. It's when she was still doing little parts, but she was in the phenomenal little part. I forgot his name. It's just an incredible cast. An incredible cast. That's
a wish list already.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And so we went to see the musical version of it. Apparently, we were the, they were testing here, and it was a test audience, because after the show ended here, it went to Broadway. In California, you either get the previews, the test audience, or you get the production afterwards. It's one or the other.
Right.
And you get the first run of the going around the country. That's one of the good things about living in San Diego or Los Angeles or San Francisco. You get the first run of it.
Yeah, everything comes here, whether it's your favorite heavy metal band or your favorite Broadway show.
Well, since I've never seen a show, it's so crazy, Scott. I've seen a show at the West End in England, but I've never seen a show on Broadway. And I lived in New Jersey for a year. But
maybe go back.
Yeah, someday. But yeah, but I have seen a lot of Broadway shows, but they were here in California.
Right. Yeah, I tend to do similar things. And whenever I can take the family to a show, we go to the Seagram here in Orange County or one of the smaller shows like Laguna Playhouse, and we try to see live productions if we can.
Oh, and you got to go see shows at La Jolla, because that's like the training ground for actors.
Right.
La Jolla Playhouse. Did you know that's how Vivian Vance got the part of Ethel in I Love Lucy, was doing a play at La Jolla Playhouse?
Is that right? I had no idea.
Yeah, they were Desi Arnaz and it was the other producer, Oppenheimer, okay. Oppenheimer, something like that. The two of them were going to different theaters to try to find somebody, because they had all these auditions and they just couldn't find the right person with the strength to be acting opposite Lucy, and yet the vulnerability of Ethel. And so it was really funny, because the character she was playing was a seductive creep, and but they saw her and they said they saw quality that they needed. They saw the strength by the character she's playing, but they're, of course, because you're playing a creep, there's always a vulnerability, so there's a balance in the character if you're in a well-written play, and she was.
Right. Okay.
And that's how she got cast.
Well, I have a little funny story about I Love Lucy myself. When I was young, living in Julian, we were little house. There was no insulation. There was no central heating. I hear people complain about, like, they don't have air conditioning. I'm like, we had a space heater for the one little space heater that we would move around from room to room for the whole house. And it gets cold in Julian.
Mm-hmm.
And a black and white TV. And I'd never seen a TV anywhere else. So I don't know, 7, 8 years old, something like that. I went to a friend's house and they were watching TV and there were color commercials on. I knew there was color TV, of course. But then I Love Lucy came on in black and white. And I'm like, wait, that's an old show? I had no idea.
It's so good. It's still funny.
It's still great. Yeah, it's one of the classics for sure.
Yeah, that's one thing. And then they, when Desi was still around, they interviewed him. He wrote his autobiography. It was called A Book. Isn't that a great name for an autobiography? somebody goes to the bookstore and says, I want a book. Oh, here! it's a really good one, too, if you ever find it. It's sort of hard to find. Although they did, they have put it on audiobook. But I want to read the book. But he was going around the country showing, you know, talking about his book. And he was, I think, I love watching interviews. And I think it was David Letterman. Yeah, it was David Letterman. And he asked, how is it that Lucy's still funny today? I mean, it's still so funny. He goes, because it was real. He said, we based a lot of the scripts on what was happening in the writers' lives, in Lucy and my life, and in different people's life. So a lot of, you know, the book flying out the window, the black eye, the window opening and closing and having a fight over whether it's going to be open and closed, all those things were happening to either him or to his writers. And they, one thing that I found really interesting, because I'm a huge Lucy fan, one thing I found really interesting when I was reading some of the books I've read about them, including his book and her autobiography too, was that Lucy was amazing about rehearsal. She would not do a scene until she rehearsed the heck out of it, knew it back and forth, made sure she understood how to handle every prop, everything, every situation, was incredibly well rehearsed before they ever did the whole thing. She would be like the dancing with the eggs. She would be practicing that for weeks before they ever even start shooting the show.
Right. That's amazing. And it shows. It shows. Those things, they looked like real life. They look spontaneous. And it's because she practiced so hard and worked at it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why.
Huh.
That's called talent.
Right. Yeah. What is it? 10% talent and 90% hard work?
Exactly.
Something like that.
Exactly. It's all sweat. But yeah, I was actually, I think it's on Paramount Plus or something that I Love Lucy's on, and I every once in a while, if I'm really upset or something in the world's got me upset, one of my go-tos is I Love Lucy, or Hot in Cleveland. Those are two of my favorites. It's not an old show, but it's still a show that always makes me laugh. Hot in Cleveland. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I love that show. Ugh. It's the last.
I've not seen the Hot in Cleveland. No.
You haven't seen it?
I watch very little television. It's just a question of time. Like, I can invest in a movie, but a series that goes on and on for several seasons, I just find myself deciding I don't have enough time to invest in that.
Well, let me give you two words. Betty White.
Okay. See, I'm laughing just hearing her name. Yes.
Yes. Great. Okay. That was her last sitcom. And okay. She's with Valerie Bertinelli, Wendy Malick, and she was in Frasier. She played the brother's wife. Really beautiful.
Okay, I won't get it, but
The listeners
will get it from that description.
Oh, yeah.
Not me.
She was also in Murphy Brown as Miles's girlfriend. I don't know if you ever saw that. But anyway, the four of them. And it's sort of Golden Girls, which is really funny because Betty was in Golden Girls too. That's one of my go-tos is Hot in Cleveland. I love that show. It's just, you don't have to watch every show, the series. They're all funny. Especially the first season. There is not one clinker in that first season. Just every episode is hilarious. And it's got like guest stars like Carl Reiner and Carol Burnett.
I used to love her.
And the guy who was in Carol Burnett show, Tim.
It's not Tim Allen.
No. Much better. Tim Conway.
Oh, Conway, yes.
Tim Conway. The great Tim Conway. These were both Carl Reiner and Tim Allen played her Betty White's boyfriends.
That's cool.
And the late Don Rickles was in as her ex-husband, or late husband, well, her husband.
I know what you're trying to say.
Yeah, because he was supposed to be dead, but he wasn't dead. And it's a sitcom, so it's really not giving anything away.
Right.
But he was in it. I'm just saying there's such... the people... they had the entire female cast of the Mary Tyler Moore Show in one episode.
Oh, wow.
Valerie Harper, Georgia Ingalls in Hot in Cleveland. But one who played Phyllis, Cloris Leachman. So it was a reunion with Betty and Georgia and Mary and Valerie and Cloris during the show. It was just incredible. if you want to watch one Hot in Cleveland, that is the one you should watch.
I'll have to do that
because it's just
funny. Have you ever heard of Robert McKee? He's a screenwriting guru, and I guess that describes him pretty well.
I don't know him, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I've taken many, many classes from him, you know, not individually, but as in a group, and I greatly respect him. But there's one area that I really think he's wrong about. He says that he calls comedy the angry art, and claims that comedians are some of the angriest people around, and they're only funny because they're, you know, poking fun at the world and showing how absurd things are. And I think there's some truth to that sometimes, but I think it shows like I Love Lucy, for example, and some others, and I think those don't strike me as angry writers. They're able to bring laughs without the anger.
I think he's talking more stand-up comedians, like Tim Allen is one. People like that. People do stand up. There's a lot of anger there. Richard Pryor, who had a really hard life. But when you're talking, it depends. I mean, most of the comedies that we're talking about, they're writing rooms with a staff. Well, I Love Lucy was three people. It was the producer I mentioned before and two more, a female and a male writer, that they were a team. They weren't
for all those episodes.
Almost all of them, except for the last about. There was a couple seasons where because they were writing, you know, they wrote 25 episodes a year. So
crazy to think about that.
Well, it's just it's even worse for other shows. Like there was, I don't know if you watch British comedies, but there was a show called As Time Goes By with Judi Dench and Jeffrey Palmer, and one person wrote seven years of shows. One person.
Wow.
I mean,
they must have felt pretty burned out by the time they turned in their last script.
Yeah. Well, they usually, I mean, British shows are shorter. They don't have as many. You know, they have, like, I think, it's not like today. Nowadays, it's like 5 episodes. But As Time Goes By was about, I'd say about 20 episodes. Maybe 15. It wasn't as long as American shows. That show was just so funny. It was so brilliant. It was a gentle. You were talking about that angry comedy. This guy was sweet, friendly old guy, just adorable. He had been writing for years. Sometimes he writes with a partner. Sometimes he writes solo. This show he wrote solo. And sweet, gentle comedy that was just a family thing. It's just adorable. It very British, making fun of Americans a lot. Use a lot of American terms and terminology. There's a lot of American terminology. So the guy must have been in California for some point writing some show. I mean,
yeah, he didn't have a lot of consultants and so forth to bounce his drafts off of, and he must have.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, like, he would have a line like, well, it's not a Senate investigation, you know. Why would a British person say that? Parliament has investigations, too. But there was a lot of stuff that was Americanisms that were in the show that you were. Sometimes we would look at each other a little surprised, you know, that popped up. So that's why.
I like to think McKee is wrong about his theory, because I write funny sometimes, I think, and I'm not an angry person, so I want to be able to do this.
I actually.
So that other people laugh.
I think that I think he's talking about like people who are stand-up comics. There's a lot of anger in stand-up comedy, you know. Well, and it is true. People laugh at something that if it wasn't done in a funny way would be a tragedy, like somebody falling on an egg and slipping and hurting themselves.
Right.
If they did it straight, that would be sad. You'd be crying, be worried for the character. But the way they do it with the music and the face and the overreaction and all that stuff, it's funny.
The light, the bright light and everything.
Yeah. But that is there's tragedy in comedy. That's why I think it's easier for a person who was trained in comedy to go into tragedy. Although, like, Judi Dench does both comedy and tragedy, and she's done 3 sitcoms. So, it just because you're trained in tragedy doesn't mean you can't do comedy.
Right.
It just depends on the person, but I can understand partially what he's saying. But I don't think you have to be angry in order to write comedy. I've written comedy. I'm not an angry person. I get upset, but I'm not an angry person.
No, it's comedy. Did you write, what was it, a short story, a screenplay, a novel?
I actually, one of my stories was originally a television script that I sent to a show. It got turned down, and I made it into, for my, I have a radio theater that's called Sherry's Playhouse, and I rewrote it for my show. And that was really funny. It was a ridiculous farce, but everybody loved it. That was one of my highest rated shows that I wrote.
I love it. It's Sherry's Playhouse. I apologize for not knowing more about it. Is it like the old time radio shows they used to do?
It started that way. Unfortunately, we do it on Blog Talk, and we had some technical issues, so now we record it and then put it on, so it's not live.
It's not live, but it's still the same kind of thing.
It's the same concept, yes. Pure audio. It has a narrator, different styles of narration, because I have about 4 or 5 people who write scripts. I usually write one script, maybe two, but I have a lot of other people who write scripts for the show, and everybody has their own. It's fun because you can experiment and try different ways to explain to the audience what they're hearing. You don't have to have, this is the narrator speaking, you know.
Well, I imagine one of the great things about it is you can have incredible stories without a budget of $100 million.
Well, that's another thing, and it's all pure imagination, so no sets, yeah. No costumes, no makeup. People do it in their jammies. I mean,
yeah.
And I have a little repertory group now of people who do Sherry's Playhouse, and it's fun. It's a lot of fun. But it's great because one of the reasons I started it was I'd entered a playwriting contest, and it was the first time since I was a teenager and I had a play in my school produced that I heard actors, and these were professional actors, not amateurs, because I had another play produced, but it was purely amateur. And this time it was professionals reading my words on stage, and I cried. It was so incredible a feeling to have professional actors bringing your words to life in ways that you probably never could imagine them do it. And so I did, I was talking to Stephen L. Sears. He's a producer, and he's a very good friend of mine, and he's also a writer and a novelist and very talented. He did Xena. he was one of the writers in Xena, and he was also one of the senior producers. And I said to him, I want to help other writers have that, and I have a platform. Would it be crazy if I did like an old-fashioned radio playhouse? And he said, no, it's a great idea. In fact, I'll interview you and we'll switch, and then we'll do a show about me interviewing you about your playhouse. And and that's what we did.
Well, you've definitely earned another listener tonight. I'm going to check that out.
Actually, we just released Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Okay, so someone took the, it's probably out of copyright.
Oh, it's novel. Well out of copyright. It's hundreds
well
of years
of copyright.
Old.
And then just made a new screenplay for your group?
Yeah, it's an adaption. And it's very short. It's like 20 minutes.
Interesting. My daughter is reading that right now for school.
Yeah. It's a good book. It's very different from our adaption. And you got to remember, I mean, it's a Victorian book, and you have to write it for 2023 sensibilities, so it's a little different.
It's shorter than I remembered. I was looking at it on the coffee table and thinking, I should probably read that again.
Yeah, you know what's really interesting about Victorian books? They're short. Like, yeah. There's, oh, well, okay, they're either really long or they're really short. Another one is Time Machine. Time Machine is short. Christmas Carol, short.
They're short, but the vocabulary in those.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Those people.
They knew how to write.
And they knew words a lot more. I have to look things up regularly when I read those.
I love Victorian novels, but you have to, like, I go through a YouTube thing that's called BookTube, and they have, like, group reads for different months. Like, October is Victorian. So we just, everybody was just reading Victorian books in October. And you need, okay, after that, in November, you gotta get into some, it's non-fiction November, which is fine, but you also have to get a little fiction that's not Victorian, just to, you know, just loosen it.
Balance it out, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Victorian books. I do. I mean, there's some books are just it's amazing, the books. Jane Eyre, Tannenwald Hall, there's so many. I can't think of them right off the top of my head, but those are the ones that popped into my head. But yeah, definitely read the book after your daughter's done.
Okay.
I hope the thing is, was she forced to read that book, or did she choose to read it for a school project?
You know, she loves to read. She reads one or two books every week. Both my daughters, actually. One is turning 13 this week, and the other is turning 15 in a month. Just tremendous readers, but I believe this was assigned to her.
Okay.
She does pick up books that surprise me, like Donna Tartt and some of the... I think maybe Jane Eyre she just picked up for herself.
Good for her. Good for her. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like that. My still one of my top favorite books is The Great Gatsby, and the first time I read that I was about 15. I thought it was a romance until I read it, and really it's a tragedy. But it's such a good book. It's still one of my favorite. It's so beautiful. Talk about beautiful prose. I mean, he's not Victorian. He's I guess you would talk.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, he was writing early, but Gatsby came in the 20s, so it was the Roaring 20 period. I mean, he coined the phrases. You know, the all those. In fact, I was reading an essay that he wrote later that's called Echoes of the Jazz Age. He created that word, and he's talking about the Jazz Age and what it really was. He says it's kind of close to it. I think it was the 50s when he wrote this essay.
Okay.
I'm actually literally just reading it. I'm like about halfway through the essay.
Oh, interesting.
And
yeah, I loved, like you say, the prose of that book, but I just never enjoyed the ending. I've read it three, maybe four times, twice required by school and twice because I'm like, I want to like this book. I love the paragraphs, but I don't know, it just was not my cup of tea, I guess.
I think because it's a tragedy. Maybe you're not a tragedy guy.
It very well could be.
Because it is a tragedy.
It all seemed a little vague and limp to me at the end. Just kind of like...
I'm sorry. I mean, I don't want to give anything away to anybody who hasn't read it. But it's not vague. It's pretty exact. It's pretty right there. The things that happen at the end, it's clear.
I don't know. I guess I'm more into the good guy pulls out a sword and they duke it out till the end.
Yeah, well, that good guy didn't have a chance.
I would have preferred it if it was from Gatsby's point of view, I think.
Yeah, but I do like Nick.
Yeah.
I like him. I like the character. I also really Sorry, I'm not a Daisy fan. I'm a Jordan fan. I don't like Daisy. But I love Jordan. Jordan is actually really a modern woman. She's a modern working woman. She's got major flaws, but compared to Daisy, she's an angel.
Yeah, no, from what I remember, which is a little vague, I agree with you on that.
I could see why Nick liked her, because they just, it was, I'm weird, okay? I'm weird. There's this Agatha Christie book I really like called The Hollow, but I like secondary characters in it.
Right.
There's a character of Midge and Edward. I really, really like them. I don't like the lead characters. I'm weird.
Well, I mean, it's a lot of times secondary characters are more interesting than the lead character, because the author is not afraid to just be goofy, because it's not the star, it's not the person carrying the whole weight, so they can try things with secondary characters that the cast around them is more interesting.
Yeah. I've always liked secondary characters. That's one of my things. And that goes for classics and modern books and all kinds of stuff. There's just something weird. I have a click, Nick. Something weird.
No, I had the same issue. So I'm releasing a novel in September. It's a young adult fantasy set in Baja. And I used to live in Mexico, and actually the house it's set in was, we have employees on my parents' farm that have worked for them. They're still there over 40 years. And it's set in one of their houses down there. But I added a second bedroom, because it only has one bedroom, in fact. But I had a hard time not making the secondary characters take over the story, because I was just doing that. I was saying, oh, this is a cool quirk. I like this habit. She's like this. And then, oh, she'll say that funny thing. And then I'm like, wait a minute. The lead character is kind of boring. So I had to really work on that and make sure some of my brilliant ideas went toward the lead characters' personality. But, of course, after you get through about chapter 10 or something, they're developed enough that they take over.
Yeah.
And that's how I find it anyway. And then I have to go back to the beginning and rewrite that with their actual personality, not the one I was trying to force on them.
That's the thing about writing, and it makes writers sound schizophrenic, but characters won't do something they don't want to do. they will fight you.
They will, and I know it's probably some schizophrenic part of our own brain that's, clearly it is, right?
You gotta be, huh? Well, I don't know. There might be.
It will resist you.
There might be a dimension of characters that come to writers and just.
It could be, right. That's why AI stories are so lifeless. They don't tap into that dimension, and they're not schizophrenic either.
No. And also, I don't know. AI is not creative. It's a function. It's a computer.
Right.
Humans, that's one of the few things we do have. We have creativity.
Are you afraid of AI and its influence on writing specifically, and creativity in that sense?
Yes. I'm not afraid of the AI itself. I'm afraid of the way people apply it.
Okay.
I don't think AI is going to take over or anything. That's what the writer strike was about, was right. That they wanted the writers to just do piecework and get rid of the writer's room and have AI do the script and then the writer come in for a day and just fix it to put in the life into it. What they were fighting. That's why the writer strike happened.
Sounds like the bean counters are trying to save money in the wrong places.
Yeah, that's also why the actor strike happened too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The actual AI, I'm not afraid of. I don't think it's going to be like the movies where the AI is going, like 2001, that the thing's going to start now. Now listen, Scott.
Right.
You shouldn't be doing that, Scott. I don't think that's going to happen. But it's like they said, it's the way they're applying it. It's not the actual AI. It's humans that are doing the stuff that I don't like.
Well, I have an interesting story not too long that kind of reassured me. I have a little magazine called New Myths, and when the whole, you know, ChatGPT came out and everything, and we had a meeting, our tech guy walked us through it because none of us knew what it was about, and my editor resigned right there, and we had to talk her off the ledge.
Oh my gosh.
But we did, and then we decided, well, what are we going to do? And we decided, rather than what most magazines were doing, which was trying to figure out how to block all AI stories, that we would actually open ourselves to AI submissions, but you had to be honest. We'll pay the same rate. We pay 3 cents a word, but you just have to tell us it's an AI submission, and we're going to label it that way. And we thought that will encourage people to be honest. And we had planned a whole contest. People could evaluate the AI stories versus human stories, what they liked better and this and that. And we're just trying to be a little contrarian in that way. And plus, can't put the cat back in the bag either. And we received over 2,000 submissions during our brief period. Was it June 1 to July 31? And there were only about 3 AI submissions. I couldn't believe it. We were not able to run our contest because we got so few submissions. Now, maybe some of the other people were lying, but I don't understand why. They would have had a much better chance getting in if they admitted they had written a really good AI story. So I was like, okay, so people are at least not yet racing to embrace it.
There was this really interesting podcast. Alan Alda has a podcast. It's about science and nature and all kinds of different things, and he had one about bots, AI bots, and he had it was a whole bunch of stuff and was really very interesting. But at the end, he asked Mike Farrell to come, and he had the AI bot write a MASH little scene from MASH, and the two of them would play. The thing was that the he said, the AI didn't do a very good job. I had to fix it.
Right.
He said it was, they did the scene. It was really, the scene was great. I mean, it was great hearing them play Hawkeye and BJ again, you know?
Acted out the scene then?
Yeah.
It
was all audio,
of
course.
That's pretty bold of them, actually.
Yeah, it was all audio, of course. And I'm sure that they got permission from, is it Paramount? Or
whoever owns MASH, right?
Yeah, I think it was Paramount. I'm sure he did. Alan Alda's not, he's a smart man. But it was an experiment. So it was great hearing them play those characters. But yeah, he was saying, he goes, yeah, Mike was going, yeah, it was a pretty good script. He goes, yeah, it was all right. We had to fix it.
Right. Well, the stories I've read that are written from it, I mean, they're not publishable, but they're not terrible. And I do know some writers, you know, who are making a living writing. I mean, these are legitimate writers who have used it to fix scenes and to brainstorm and this sort of thing. None of them are actually writing even full chapters with it and fixing it. But if they're stuck, or there's a paragraph that's just not working or whatever, then they're trying it, and they seem to be satisfied that it gets them unstuck again. I have not touched it after that one day with our tech guy.
Yeah,
I probably should. I think it might be useful for things like business plans and things like that. But I'm just too stubborn. I spent years trying to learn how to write a good paragraph. I do not want to learn how to write a prompt and find out AI does a better job than I do.
I rather write my own stuff. It may take me longer. It may be harder. I may have to scrap something and redo something, but I'd rather it be me.
Right.
That's just me. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who love it, but I'm not. I have not embraced it.
Well, you know what? So this is reminding me of something kind of odd and roundabout, but there's a thing going around on the internet, Girl with a List. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so it's apparently a young woman who has written a list of like 200 things. I've not seen the list. I've seen people talking about it. 200 thing reasons, you know, not to have a baby, and like a dozen reasons to have it. And I've heard some of the lists and everything, and I can think of so many problems with the list. But one of them that came to my mind is that some of the negatives that she had down there were things that make you grow, mm-hmm. and make you a much more generous, you know, selfless, and mature person. So yeah, they're hard and they might be painful at the time, but you become a much better person for it. And the same thing is true in this writing. I mean, if you spend, you know, hundreds of hours writing a novel, you're a different person at the end of it. Mm-hmm. You've really worked hard and you've learned something about yourself. Whereas if you write a few prompts, I don't think you're going to benefit that way.
I just think that I understand it. You don't grow unless you do something, go through hard stuff. You need to reach out and try new things in order to grow as a human being. It's just like, it's not even just any kind of creativity, whatever you're doing, whether it's, like when my mom used to do painting or needlepoint or her art, she would do these, needlepoint came with a picture, and she would like get different colors and do entirely different thing than what the picture was. And what she had a real good eye, and it was gorgeous. I mean, I'm sure it would have been nice if she did exactly the picture that was on it, but it was so much better with her eye and doing what she did. You know what I mean?
Right. Totally. Some of her is in there, and
I mean, we have like a selection. We have a lot of needlepoints that my mom did. They're gorgeous. Okay. They're like tapestries. They're just beautiful.
Wow. Yeah. I love that.
So I wanted to ask you, you talked a little bit about your book. When's it coming out? How's it coming out? All that good stuff.
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, so the title is Memories of Lucinda Echo, and I actually wrote it through a program at Stanford. I got a lot of feedback, and a lot of it was from Lauren Cate, who's the author of Fallen. So I'm really proud of this project, and we decided to publish it through my own publishing company in September 17th, to be exact. And part of it's because it's set in Baja California and involves all Mexican protagonists and so forth, and it's, I believe that's Hispanic Heritage Day is what they call that day. Anyway, very excited about it. And it, I think, involves, it's a setting I've never seen in any novel, for one thing. It's one I'm very familiar with. And I think the magic system and so forth is pretty unique.
I think that's cool. I think that's great. Now, I do have one more. You were with Writers of the Future. How did that come about?
Well, thanks for asking. So, that came about because I was a graduate of the Odyssey Fantasy Writing Workshop, and I'd heard about Writers of the Future. Someone had given me the early anthology, and I loved, you know, every story. And I wanted to enter, but I asked the head of Odyssey, Jean Cavellos, you know, if she would recommend that, and she did, as just a great forum and probably definitely the most prized for non-professional sci-fi fantasy writers. And so I entered it every quarter for about 3 years. I wrote short stories. I entered them. I got one honorable mention, which was really, really inspiring. And then I got second place for my story, Insect Sculptor. So, and that was really, not only was it thrilling, but I tell people, you know, what was the best thing that came out of it? Well, they have an award show, and I think one of the like second or third place winners from American Idol sang, and it's just a huge black tie event. amazing show that they put on. And so I went there and I got called up, I got my award and everything, gave a little speech. And as I was walking away with my wife, she turns to me and she says, "Okay, you can spend time writing." because before, I mean, she would let me, but it was always a little begrudging, like, well, shouldn't you be cleaning the garage or, you know, this sort of thing. But so it was great. So that's how that came about. And, you know, they've been really good to me ever since. I mean, they help winners publish things in the, after the event. And they invited me on to be on their podcast. And it's been great.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So what was the number on the book that you were in?
Okay, 28. Volume 28. And Insect Sculptor is the name of the story.
Okay.
And I'm a little bit sad because the year after, they changed the format and the artwork became gorgeous full-color inserts. And in mine, it was still the little black and white, you know, I forget what you call this size book, but it's not the trade paperback, it's the other kind.
I just want to thank you for taking time out of your day and coming on my show. I really appreciate it.
Sherry, it was a great pleasure. I can't wait to listen to your radio dramas.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's a lot of comedies.
Radio shows, I will amend.
Okay, all right. I hope you like them. Thank you so much. And
all right, you take care.
Thank you, you too. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.